Blog Talk Radio.
Full Fill Radio, a voice you can trust. Broadcasting live presents Two Guys and a Bible with Don Preston and William Bell. Join us each week at 7 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Central as we bring you exciting, sound, challenging, and comforting messages regarding the end times. Thank you for tuning in today. Don Preston is the founder of Preterist Research Institute, or PRI. Don is a prolific author, having written and published 19 books, a host of audio and DVD studies, and is a debater and defender of the full preterist view. His websites are BibleProphecy.com, Eschatology.org, and DonKPreston.com. William Bell is the founder of AllThingsFulfilled.com Ministries and has a website bearing the same name, and has authored 3 books, audios, and DVDs. He has published hundreds of articles and recordings. And now, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Two Guys and a Bible broadcast with Don Preston and William Bell.
Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Two Guys and a Bible with Don Preston and myself. We're delighted to be here. Great to be back from PPW, Preterist Pilgrim Weekend 2017, and we had a great time. We're going to be sharing some of that with you. Don, how are you today?
I am very, very well, Dr. William Bell. Yeah. It really was a great weekend. I'm about to get recovered from being so tired. You know, as you well know, putting together a conference, doing all the logistical work, and especially this year, since Jan could not be as much help as possible, it was a little bit extra tiring. But I tell you what, the help that we received this year was absolutely fantastic. Jim and Sharon Wade, as usual, just pitched right in and kind of took the bull by the horns. Rod and Connie Rupert pitched in. They had never helped before. They're regulars in attending the conference, but they had never been called on to help out like this. And boy, they were just champions. And of course, we had Martha Pryor, who's been here almost every year. We had some other people, John and Gay Newman, who are from just up the road. And I mean, you know, it's just one person after another that just pitched in and helped in any way that they could. And it went off flawlessly. I'm not aware of any major glitches at all. And of course, my part is generally dealing with all of the speakers and those logistical details having to do with travel and accommodations and what have you. So if there were any major glitches, I was certainly unaware of them. But I think we had a really, really good conference.
Yeah, there didn't appear to be any glitches as far as I could see. And I was just amazed at how quickly this conference passed. You know, for me, at least. I don't know how it felt to anyone else. But, man, it seemed like it was over just after getting started, you know, but I think that was because the lessons, in my opinion, were very good from all of the speakers who were there, from Holger Neubauer, Daniel Rogers, yourself, and Michael Sullivan, just did an awesome job, and a lot of interest as each person was speaking, and so I guess that made the lessons go by. I don't know what it was. It was something I noticed that I looked up and said, "Phew, this thing is over almost." And but I thought that was because, you know, everybody had such a great time and it went along very smoothly. And I do remember the Ruperts working and along with Jim Wade and his wife, who always do a great job every single year. And I mean, you know, I'm glad Jan got the opportunity to rest from all of the efforts and labor that she puts in to that event, but you know, I have to commend everybody who put it together, who worked to support it. Fantastic job on all of their parts.
Yeah, I forgot to mention Richard and Kay Owendowski. I saw Kay sitting out at the registration table a couple of different times, and that's always a tremendous help. And so, and like I said, I may be missing someone, and I apologize if I am missing someone, but boy, it's just so wonderful to see people just pitch in like that and volunteer their help, just do whatever is needed in order to make things go smoothly. So yes, I agree with you that it went by so swiftly. I made comment to Jan when I came home on Friday. I brought her a little bit of lunch home, and just to check on her and what have you. And I told her, I said, this thing's almost half over already. I said, it seemed like we just barely got started and we're almost half over. And I agree. We really, really had some great lessons. I appreciate so much the excellent job of preparation that each one of the men put in, including you, of course. I thought your background presentation for the study of the redemption of creation was so extremely helpful. It was so thorough in pointing out that this creation, the redemption of creation, certainly is not of animals or whatever, but it goes all the way back to creation, man that had fallen through sin, and that it is kind of an all-encompassing concept of man under sin, alienated from God, that was in need of the manifestation as the sons of God. And so when you actually came to Romans chapter 8 and you brought it home, that the imminence that is there in the text just absolutely permeates the text, and thus God's scheme of redemption had reached its climax, reached that point in which, to use a terminology from Haggai, the desire of all the nations had finally arrived, or was on the cusp of arriving. I don't remember using that text, but I think it's very, very appropriate.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it most definitely is. Well, I appreciate those comments. I'm, you know, really grateful that, you know, someone was able to kind of see what I was attempting to do in the process.
I thought it was a unique approach. I had never heard or seen that approach taken before, but it was a comprehensive approach, and that's what I appreciated about it. You know, sometimes we have a tendency just to kind of jump into any given text and exegete it right there, which there's no fault in that, but to get the broader context, to get the comprehensive context and background for a passage like that especially, is extremely helpful. And it makes it extremely difficult for anyone to refute what you were laying out there, what you iterating as you demonstrated. Hey, Romans chapter 8 goes back to Genesis. Romans chapter 8 is what Adam longed for. And so, like I said, I really appreciated that approach. My personal approach to Romans chapter 8, boy, I just jump right in and I point out the suffering of the present time was eschatological suffering. I go into the time statements that are there. I go into what did it mean for the manifestation of the sons of God. And, of course, you covered some of that, especially in your second presentation. But, again, I just really enjoyed the comprehensive nature of the approach to it. And, you know, the same is true of all of the speakers. I thought each one of the men just did a bang-up job in really providing the context, in really providing more than abundant material information and evidence to support what they were saying. You hear so many times of people just talking about the Bible, making claims about the Bible, and you don't hear actual exegesis. And so to me, it's just so great when you can have lessons that are so thorough, that are so in-depth, that are so comprehensive. It's just very, very good.
Yeah, well, I know we're going to get into, you know, everybody else's lessons, but, you know, you did some excellent lessons as well on Romans 11. I thought was outstanding job on that text. And, you know, what was amazing that even at the end of the lesson, you know, there were people asking for the verses to make sure they got all of the information that you had presented from Isaiah 27 and from Isaiah 59, everything that you tied in to the context of Romans 11. And I mean, for the postmillennialists, as well as any of the other millennialists, as far as all millennialists or dispensationalists, I mean, you know, you just definitely take away everything that they might try to hang their hats on as far as, you know, that text is concerned. And I have to say also that for anyone in covenant eschatology, in terms of delineating and explaining, exegeting Romans 11, your presentations on Romans 11 have been the best that I've seen, the most detailed, the most intricately developed, and the most clear in terms of bringing out the meaning of that text. You know, and I've read from others, but no one has really delved into it from that perspective. It's like, to one degree, you know, they kind of quote, as you were saying a moment ago, you know, they talk about the Bible, and not that these were doing so, they were quoting the passages, but none have gone through the in-depth correlations that you've made, both in your discussions with men like Kurt Simmons and some of the other dispensations that you've debated, as well as the amillennialists that you've debated with David Hester, et cetera. But, I mean, your work on that is, and I suppose we should be looking for the book sometime in the near future just on Romans 11, because that material is just absolutely incredible. And then in that lesson on the war, you definitely impressed that on my mind even greater to look at the fact that, you know, it was not the wars. And so for all of this, you know, long ongoing historical process of these dispensational views, that it was actually the war, and that, and you tied that into, you know, 70 AD and that event very well. So excellent job on your part as well. And I just think everybody just did a fantastic job, but you did a great job on those.
Well, I appreciate that. I'll share a little secret with you. I had actually planned to use that slot to just give some update on what's going on in the world and in the movement of preterism, because as you very well know, there's some really, really exciting things going on. But as I was sitting there listening to you, you know, Chad Kennell, who did just an absolutely great job setting up the live stream, and I've had tremendous comments about the good job that he did, but he had a scroll along the bottom. It says, coming up, Don Preston on the salvation of all Israel in Romans 11. And I thought, I am? I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
So I thought, well, it looks like I'm speaking on Romans chapter 11.
Yeah. So, and I have to chime in on Chad Kennell. I don't want to interrupt you, but go ahead.
That's fine. No, that's fine. I was just simply saying that, you know, as I said at the very, very beginning of the lesson on Romans 11, it used to be a passage that troubled me, perplexed me, challenged me, and it's still a very challenging text. I'm not trying to say it's simple by any means, but I really believe that the material that I presented, along with a ton of other material that can be presented on Romans 11, on the prophetic background and prophetic source, really is definitive for the interpretation of the text. And by the way, you say about a book, in my book, Elijah Has Come, a solution to Romans 11, 25 to 27, I have that very development in that book. So for those who are interested in seeing my thoughts on the fuller explanation of Romans 11, 25 to 27, I would urge you to get a copy of that book. Again, it is entitled Elijah Has Come, a Solution for Romans 11, 25 to 27. I literally do not know of another book that addresses Romans 11 in the way that I develop in that book. It's just incredible material to me. And I mean, literally, I surveyed, I don't even know how many commentaries. And the point that I'm making and the point that I made in regard to the fact that scholars acknowledge, freely acknowledge, that Paul is citing Isaiah 27, Isaiah 59, Daniel 9, Jeremiah 31, 29 to 31. And yet, William, I have not seen even one single scholar discuss the implications and the application of what it means when Paul said that he was waiting for the fulfillment of those prophecies. I have read commentators who say, well, Isaiah was predicting the salvation of Israel. Paul's looking back on it as the cross. And that's just simply fallacious. But anyway, I just want everyone to know that if they want a fuller development of my thinking on Romans 11, that they can get that book, Elijah Has Come, A Solution to Romans 11, 25 to 27.
Well, very good. I will put that on my reading list. I have the book, but I'll put it on my reading list to get it done very, very soon. And if you want more information to see how the how his presentations on Romans 11 stand up in debate, then go back and check out the Michael Brown debates that Don had with him, that first one particularly, and you will see that. Did the discussion with Jaime Pickett cover that a little bit? There were so many interruptions with him that I couldn't. I mean, it was just kind of strange trying to keep up with that.
I agree with that 100%. That was pretty bad. But yes, indeed, I did develop in my YouTube debate with Jaime Pickett that you moderated. I developed the information from Isaiah 27, from Isaiah 59, demonstrating that both Isaiah 27 and Isaiah 59 foretold the salvation of Israel. Both of them predict the salvation of Israel at the time of the judgment of Israel for shedding innocent blood. Jesus said that all of the blood of all of the righteous would be avenged in his generation. Therefore, Isaiah 27, Isaiah 59, and therefore Romans 11 was fulfilled in AD 70. And Dr. Pickett never touched it top, side, or bottom. He never one time addressed the issue. And I can say the same. When I made the argument inclusive of Isaiah 27, Isaiah 59, in my first debate with Dr. David Hester here in Ardmore, July of 2016, Dr. Hester didn't even understand the argument. After my first presentation, he actually walked up to a group of people. Now, this was reported to me. I did not hear it myself. So if it's not true, then it was reported to me wrongly. But it was reported to me by two different people that he, after I got through with my first presentation and we were in the break, he walked up to a group of men and said, "Does anybody understand what Don just said?" Well, that's pretty sad. That's horribly sad for a man that claims to understand eschatology. And he doesn't even understand an argument based upon the prophetic background of Romans chapter 11, 25 to 27. And yet, really, honestly, and I don't want to be unkind, but I'm not surprised at all, given his approach in both debates now, Dr. Hester has virtually no grasp of eschatology. He certainly does not understand a great deal about hermeneutic, even though he taught a class on hermeneutic. And I said during our debate, I really honestly feel sorry for any student sitting under Dr. Hester's tutelage in a class on hermeneutic, because they're not going to understand hermeneutic when they're through. And I'm not trying to be unkind, but his approach to Scripture is absolutely unscriptural. It violates the rules of Hebraic apocalyptic language. It violates context. It violates linguistic. It violates audience relevance. I mean, you name it, and Dr. Hester's approach to eschatology is an overt violation of every solid, sound rule of interpretation that you could find.
Well, I would certainly agree with that. And all you have to do is listen to the debates, and you can see that that is the case. Some of the things that he says and the approaches that he takes are just totally foreign to any hermeneutic class that I've ever taken. And you can check out the books for that, and you'll see that to be the case. Well,
you were going to say,
yeah,
something,
going to say something about
Chad,
and I wanted to say that, you know, when I first looked at the live stream, that I was so impressed with the clarity that I had to take a second look at it. And of course, I watched a couple of the speeches on the live stream, and you know, everything was just absolutely incredible in terms of the use of the cameras, you know, and the way he switched back and forth from that. They, you know, it was just so professionally done, and that I had to comment on it. I actually put a review on Facebook, made a comment on Facebook on his page, letting him know how much I appreciated, you know, what he did and how he handled that entire process. And so, and on top of that, the very spirit and attitude that he had, you know, was definitely something that was worthy of note as well. And so he was a very humble person, very sincere person about what he was doing, and just seemingly wanted to do the very best that he could to put everything in the best possible light from a technical standpoint of view. And he did that, and he went, you know, above and beyond in making that happen. So I just want to, you know, acknowledge the job that he did. And I know we've had good technical guys all the time, but this was his first time, I think, doing it, and he did an awesome job. And, you know, I mean, you can't take anything from it. And, of course, even after I heard, you know, read that he had put in about 15 hours just getting everything uploaded, and he's still waiting on documentation from me, which I got to get to. But at the same time, he just, you know, he just did a fantastic job. So I'm very pleased with what he did. And again, if you look at the quality of what he produced, it was excellent.
Yeah, I agree, and I've heard numerous comments to that effect of how everyone was pleased. And as you said, you know, Joseph Spencer's done a fine job in the past. He has not had the equipment to work with that Chad did. And I've got to reveal this. Chad Kennell went out and bought a bunch of equipment on his own dime to ensure that he had the proper equipment to do the job that he did. And that just simply, I mean, it totally blew me away. And so, like I said, Joseph Vincent has always done just a great, great job in the past, given the equipment. I must say, we very often limited him because we didn't have the equipment that he needed. At different times, pardon me, he might say, "Don, we've absolutely got to have the following part. Can you please get this?" And so I'd order it real quick, or I'd give him the money. He would go to Staples and get it. So I know that Joseph would have done the same job had he had the same amount of equipment, but we just didn't have the funds to provide the equipment for him. So hats off to both of those guys. Hats off to Chad for having the equipment on hand and the expertise. I mean, he's a young guy. He has dedicated himself to learning, to knowing, and to applying that expertise. And it's just a tremendous blessing. You know, I was talking to Joseph Vincent afterward, by the way, and he was commenting on what a good job had been done. And he said, "Well, maybe if Chad could possibly come back," he said, "maybe that would free me up to where I could actually speak at one of the seminars." And so and that will probably happen, by the way. So, you know, it's just one of those type of things. As we encounter more and more talented people, as more and more people come into the movement of preterism, we will have that availability of people who are eager and willing and desirous of helping the movement. And that's exactly what happened here. When Joseph informed me that he could not come this year due to some other obligations, boy, I was absolutely frantic. I didn't know what I was going to do. So I got on Facebook and I posted and I said, "Here's what we need." And someone, I forgot now, and I apologize for this, but someone said, "You need to contact Chad Kennell." I reached out to Chad Kennell and I said, "Is there any way that you would be interested in this? Do you have the expertise to do this?" I said, "Here's what we can provide." And he jumped all over the top of it. And I was just absolutely thrilled. And by the way, we do need to point this out, William. I pointed it out on, I think, the last in my closing presentation. But it's absolutely hilarious to me. You and I hear this very often from detractors, enemies of covenant eschatology. They say, you know, they're just a tiny few, tiny little handful of you guys. You don't amount to anything. Well, in the first place, if there's so few of us, why are you spending so much time trying to refute us? Point number two, I've been told over the on Facebook over the last couple of months by two different individuals, people are abandoning preterism and covenant eschatology by the drove. They're abandoning them. You know, they're not interested in what Don Preston has to say anymore. And yet, strangely enough, we had a viewership in the thousands. William, are you aware of any other preterist activity that has ever had a viewership in the thousands?
No, I don't recall. I know that, you know, in the earlier days, you know, we didn't have the kind of technology we have today.
Well,
it wasn't as advanced. And but even in some of our previous ones, we've never had that to occur, as far as I know, in terms of keeping any statistics are concerned. So that's good. And even as you were saying that, Don, I was sitting here thinking, you know, it's about time for us to step up the game a little bit. I know that our seminars have been limited a lot of times because of funding, and so we can only have so many men. Like, you know, when I get ready to put on a seminar, I'm trying to figure out, count my pennies and figure out, okay, how many can I bring this year? And without somebody like you who say, okay, I'll pay my airfare, you know, so that helps us out a lot and others. But, you know, it's time for us to put on a bigger event. And we've got it, you know, we're getting more speakers and excellent speakers. And can you imagine, you know, when we start having these seminars and we have, you know, they last for a couple of days or more, and we have a sufficient number of speakers. And we have some, because we have to start leaving out speakers now just to kind of put on a modest seminar. But, hey, it's time to step this game up, and let's do it even bigger. We may have to pick a city and then pool some resources and just put on a joint effort that's even larger than what we've done before. And, of course, Memphis is a good place to start.
Well, there you go. We may have to work toward that very thing. I'm certainly in favor of anything that can move the movement forward, that can generate more interest and create excitement. I mean, and we both know, William, there are preterists out there who are craving fellowship, who feel so alone, and yet who are doing their very best to maintain their faith in the Lord and their trust in His Word. And look, there were people at our conference. I'm certainly not going to name any names, but we had one individual there. Won't even tell you if it was a man or a woman. But we had one individual there who walked up and told me, well, I just have to tell you, I have been fighting this for 2 years. And I said, what do you mean you've been fighting it? And they said, well, I just haven't allowed myself to come for 2 years. They said, he, she, they said, couldn't fight it anymore. Had to come. And I know that by the end of the seminar, this individual was very excited and walked up to me and asked, are you reachable? Will you communicate with me? Because I may need some help. And I said, I will be more than happy to help in any way that I possibly can. And so it's going to be interesting to see what becomes in this particular individual's situation, whether or not they can generate some interest in their circle of friends and see if she or see if they can see if they can cause interest to spring up where they are at. But that's happening everywhere, over and over and over again.
Absolutely.
Go ahead.
I just wanted to comment briefly on the statement that you made about people who are in remote areas, or they're they don't have the kind of fellowship that some of us experience. And I'm not going to say, you know, male or female or anything, but, you know, not too long ago received a message about someone that was really having a hard time because of some rejection that had been experienced by the local congregation, and just felt horrible about it, felt ostracized a bit, even from their family. And I took some time to just write them, encourage them, et cetera. And it made a huge difference to let them know. And, you know, when you've been through the kind of stuff that you get put through when you become a believer and a person who advocates, you know, fulfilled eschatology, and, you know, you're trying to stay as close to the Bible as you possibly can in understanding these things, and especially from the kind of background that we're from, and it's not just our background, because we learn from even others who are in different fellowships that they experience some of the same things. But it just helps you to be able to empathize with them, to know what they're going through, to know how they feel, to know that sense of loneliness, and that sense of, you know, you're a scumbag and you're a false teacher, and, you know, we shouldn't even give you any grace whatsoever. Let's just separate from. I mean, it's a horrible feeling for people who care about family and loved ones, et cetera. And so to be there to just say some kind words to them, to let them know how much they appreciated during that process is very important, and to let them know how much we appreciate them standing and supporting us as well in helping them through the, you know, through learning and teaching, et cetera, because they are a great part of what we do in terms of the support that they offer, their well wishes. Some of them even support financially, and we appreciate all of that. But it's important to acknowledge them as well, because they need the encouragement to continue moving forward.
Amen. Words well spoken. I mean, I have said many times, I have such profound appreciation for the people that, like you're talking about, who are in isolated areas. They have been ostracized, and yet they continue to study, and when given the opportunity, they share, and they just continue to be faithful. And that takes a tremendous amount of dedication, a tremendous amount of love and courage for the Lord. So we appreciate that so very, very much. And, you know, by the way, I want to interject something right here, William. I received and spent about 30 minutes on the phone yesterday. We very often talk, and we want to get back to a review of Preterist Pilgrim Weekend, but I just really have to share this. I was contacted yesterday by the vice president of a university in Canada. This vice president told me that he is from the Campbell Stone Restoration Movement background. Now, he and his fellowship have kind of moved into the Disciples of Christ arena of that fellowship. And yet, nonetheless, this gentleman told me, and I think many of our listeners may relate to this. He said, I was raised a very firm and very staunch dispensationalist. He said, I had the timelines down. I had everything down. And he said, I found myself continually living in fear. I came to fear God. I came to fear the Bible. I came to fear the world. I came to fear everything. And he said, I found myself drawing inward ever more, ever more, ever more. And he said, I stumbled onto your videos. And I'm not saying this at all to pat myself on the back. Same would have been true if he'd found William's videos or the videos of any number of other preterists. But he happened to find mine. And he said, it has turned my world upside down. And he said, the truth is so simple and yet so profound. It is so easy to understand, you know, as opposed to Larkin's charts. And, you know, it's interesting, William. I've had two people over the last 2 days write and tell me that they were followers of Larkin's dispensational chart, and yet they always found it incredibly complex and incredibly confusing. Well, yeah, no joke. If you've ever looked at Larkin's charts, yeah, incredibly complex, certainly describes it. But anyway, this individual, vice president of a Christian university, told me, he said, I want to find a way to help you further your ministry in Canada. And so we had a good long talk. He is in the process now of drafting and formulating a plan, a proposal of how we can work together to not only introduce but to spread covenant eschatology in Canada. He said, I don't know when I have been so excited about the Word of God. And so I want everyone to keep that in their prayers because, boy, talk about exciting. We will see what develops, but my goodness, that's exciting. William, are you there?
Yes, I had already started talking, but at any rate, that's excellent. Can you hear me?
I can hear you, yes.
Okay,
yes,
great.
I hear you.
Yeah, I was just saying that that's excellent news, and I think it's just going to increase, but that's absolutely fantastic. And there's already some very strong, advocates of covenant eschatology in Canada who are students and very knowledgeable, because some of them are on my live streams, on my Google Hangout broadcast, and I've talked to others over the years. So I know that they're there, and to get something stronger and develop there will be just absolutely, absolutely fantastic. And, I would anticipate that this is something that's going to continue to happen as we continue moving forward.
I think you're exactly right. We have said this many, many times. We are living in exciting times. Walls are being torn down. In some areas, the resistance is fading. Hearts are opening up that have never been opened up before. Now, is there continued resistance? Well, of course there is. I mean, there's no question about that, and resistance will continue. But that's okay. We've got the guns. We've got the ammunition. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, some of that resistance is good, because without some of the pushback that we get, we wouldn't delve into some of these passages more carefully as we do. I mean, the moment we get what everybody else thinks is a super objection or something we haven't looked at before, I mean, we just kind of hone in on it and make sure
that
we didn't miss something. If we did, we acknowledge it. But if we didn't, then it just makes the truth shine brighter. So, and that's what I'm seeing. I saw it in some of the lessons that were presented during the PPW.
Yes.
Arguments people threw out there, for example, in Hoger's lesson, he pointed out things. Of course, Mike Sullivan, everybody did, but they're bringing up these certain little points, and we all address them in the Q&A that they think are really, really strong arguments or issues that we haven't considered before, or things that they think is going to derail us. And we just go in and show how they have misunderstood, because the paradigm that we have, I mean, we have looked at where they are. We've been there. We believe those things. We have to teach ourselves out of them because of the paradigm that the Bible presented before us. So what really gets me sometimes, Don, is how naive they think we are, in that we didn't go through the process of examining all of those arguments. To say that we've seen them all, I can't say that, but we certainly saw all the so-called major ones that they think that they're presenting before us, and quite frankly, in most of the cases, are surprised that they don't give us credit for having done so. That to think that we didn't look at Revelation 1:7 and Matthew 24:30 and other texts like that before we, and the Lord's Supper. I mean, all of those things came up early on in the journey. And they think that they're the strongest arguments out there, and just shows you how little they understand about, as you said earlier, covenant eschatology.
Well, that's exactly right. I'm just like you. I'm sometimes just almost dumbfounded at how naive And I use the word ignorant, not to be caustic, not to be harsh, but are they truly so ignorant of what we actually teach, what we actually believe, that they think that we have not, as you pointed out so well a moment ago, you mean to tell me they think that we have never struggled in our own studies with Revelation 1:7, with Acts chapter 1, 9, and following? Do they actually believe that we haven't thought about those texts? It's just amazing how naive they can be. And yet, I have to tell you, William, I think to a certain extent, some of those individuals have never thought past their nose. They haven't gone into the studies. And it's, for instance, on Revelation 1:7. I mean, I was raised believing that Revelation 1:7 is the end of the world. After all, it's every eye shall see him. I mean, everyone knows what every eye is, don't they? And so when I look closer at, wait a minute, these things must shortly come to pass. And of course, you have men like David Hester, who on any other occasion, if he was debating a premillennialist, he would honor the time statements. But when he's debating us, he gets up there and he gives this rambling, almost incoherent attempt to negate the time statements. I mean, it was just absolutely, it was almost unfathomable how bad his so-called argument on the time statements was. It was more ridicule than it was anything. And it is a good example of how David Hester, if he honestly taught, and I guess he did, hermeneutic, he ought to know that you cannot go to another passage of Scripture to negate the meaning of another passage of Scripture. And what I mean by that is David Hester believes that when John the Baptizer said, "Repent, for the kingdom of heaven has drawn near," David Hester agrees and acknowledges "has drawn near" meant absolutely has drawn near. It was fulfilled within 3 years, 3.5 years. It was fulfilled on Pentecost in Acts chapter 2. So he would argue all day long that at hand truly meant at hand. But when we apply the same identical verse or word in the same identical Greek tense in James chapter 5, the parousia has drawn near, all of a sudden David wants to run to the Old Testament. And he wants to find, in a desperate search, in a desperate attempt to find some passage, somewhere, somehow, that did not mean truly imminent. And he has to twist it and distort it to make it mean that. So he runs down there to Isaiah chapter 56, verses 1 to 6, a passage that he thinks doesn't mean imminence. And he says, see? In Isaiah 56, 1 to 6, at hand doesn't mean at hand. Therefore, the coming of the Lord in James 5 wasn't really at hand. Folks, that's the worst hermeneutic you could possibly imagine. I mean, it is absolutely horrid. And I can tell you this. If David Hester was sitting in a legitimate class on hermeneutic, and he were to make that argument, he would be castigated by any teacher who understands the proper use of hermeneutic. That's just awful. And so this is what we mean when we talk about how these fellows attack covenant eschatology, and they think that we are so naive, so ignorant ourselves, that we've never even considered these arguments on Revelation 1:7, every eye shall see him. We've never thought about he shall come in like manner. We have never, ever thought about he shall come with flaming fire. Why, we've never thought of those things. And so when David Hester says, well, did anybody see Jesus come in flaming fire? That's supposed to just confound us and refute us, when in reality it betrays his ignorance of Hebraic eschatology. And it's really pretty appalling.
Right. Well, look, we're about to run out of time, and I do want to spend time saying about, you know, talking about the other speakers. You know, we still had Daniel Rogers and Mike Sullivan and Holger Neubauer in terms of their presentations. And I, you know, when Daniel Rogers was speaking, I got even word from my congregation of how much they appreciated his lesson that he did, and how much more clarity they had on the subject as a result of his presentations. And, you know, that young man is just, you know, he's just an outstanding young fella that has a good grasp, not only on covenant eschatology, but on the Bible itself, and is able to really put together some great lessons, some great work. He's done some great reviews. He's done, you know, good stand-in lessons for you, and I think people really appreciate his style and his manner. And so he just did an outstanding job. And so his lessons were good. And you know, I mentioned I was in the hotel room actually listening to one of his speeches, and I was getting ready to pick up my laptop and come over because I was watching it on the live stream. And then he got to a point. I said, I can't leave. And I had to sit there and listen to the rest of it because I didn't want to miss anything that he said, you know, in the lesson. And just did an outstanding job of being clear, being very scriptural in terms of the supporting of his points, and very logical, and just did an outstanding job.
Well, I agree, and I think one of the things that I appreciate about Daniel so much is that he has done so much of his own independent study. You know, you and I, William, basically had to come to our views almost on our own. We didn't have a wealth of books out there. We did not have a wealth of individuals that we could call and say, hey, what do you think about this? What do you think about that? And as you well know, I stated early on in my journey into covenant eschatology, I did not want to read what a lot of other people had to say, even though I appreciated then and I appreciate now Max King and his courage, his dedication. I may not agree with where he's at right now, but that's beside the point. The point was that if you don't appreciate the work that Max King has done, then you've got the wrong attitude, basically, in my estimation. But I did not want to read his book on the cross and the parousia, lest someone accuse me of being just simply a disciple of Max King. And, you know, I still have not to this day sit down and read cover to cover, as they say, but I most assuredly pick it up every once in a while. I go to the scripture index. I look up a text just to see what Max wrote at that time. And he has tremendous insights. And yet, all of that said, as much as I appreciate the work that Max did, I felt the burden. I really felt the burden to make up my own mind. And down through the years, I've appreciated so much the work that he did that once I had my own framework, or once I had my mind, you know, headed in a certain direction that I thought was correct, then I could go and I could read his comments. And so very often he filled out things for me that I had not quite seen. And so even though he did not formulate my views, he certainly was and has been through the years an assistance in that. Well, I appreciate that in Daniel Rogers. And by the way, I appreciate that in Michael Sullivan. Michael Sullivan does a tremendous amount of independent thinking, and we both know that Holger does the same thing. He didn't want to read us.
Yep.
You know? He didn't want anything to do with us. And so I appreciate all three of those men for their independence and their willingness to think for themselves. And obviously, I appreciate them for the courage that they have and have had and have to take a stand for the truth. You know, I knew for a fact that Michael Sullivan would never, ever, ever get through all of his material. He presented some of that at David Curtis's conference a couple of years ago at Virginia Beach. It was extremely well organized, chart after chart after chart after chart. And, you know, every once in a while, Mike will Facebook message me and say, Don, what do you think about this? What's your insight on that? And yet, clearly, he has done a tremendous amount of thought and study research on it on himself. Occasionally I'm able to offer some insights, but he would say, well, I've got this chart, this, and I sit back and thinking, there is no way under God's blue heaven he's going to get through all this material. he could take two charts that he had developed, and he had plenty of material in two charts to last for both sermons and to completely destroy postmillennialism.
Yeah, yeah. So, well, in terms of volume of content, he reminds me of you, because both of you all produce large volumes of content. Mike writes a lot, and even his articles are you know, very thorough, very comprehensive.
Yes.
And so he kind of reminds me of you in terms of, you know, the depth of which he writes. And so he definitely puts out a lot of information.
Well, he does that. And, you know, I really appreciated Holger's approach to the new creation concept as well. It was, to a certain extent, like yours. It starts back at creation. And he marched from creation onward to the new creation of Revelation 21 and 22. And it gave people a really, really good overall comprehensive view of the biblical narrative of how God from the very beginning was planning for the consummation. And that consummation was not to be literal. It was not to be physical. It was not to be a creation made by hands. It was, in fact, to be the new creation of Jesus Christ, the new covenant creation of Jesus Christ. So I think that our speakers just overall did an outstanding job. It's always, as you know, William, you were talking a while ago, you know, there have been the times in which we have struggled as we were going to put on a seminar. We said, well, who are we going to get? Who are we going to get? Well, in the past, I could always say, well, I'm going to have William Bell. Now who am I going to get? You know, and for a little short time, I could say, well, I'm going to get William. I'm going to get Jack Scott, maybe Larry Siegel. Well, I still call on Larry Siegel from time to time. Jack Scott's moved off to the Netherlands, and his job doesn't allow him, as I understand it, to be involved. And so that kind of eliminates that situation. And so for a good long while, it was like, okay, who are we going to get now? Who are we going to get? But it's so great that now we can draw from an ever-expanding pool of speakers, of men, and many of them, by the way, and this is so refreshing, many of them are young men that have really, really done a lot of study, just like Daniel Rogers that we were talking about. And, for instance, I'm waiting for a CD now with a couple of sermons on it by a young man that was there this year. And he and I have corresponded, and he does preaching already. And I want to be able to listen to a couple of his lessons to know how he presents himself, you know, the quality of his sermonizing, so to speak. And that's just one more name to be thrown into the pot, as it were, of potential speakers in the future. You know, there's a young man, I suppose he's in his mid-40s now, and that's looking younger all the time. But at one time, he was considered one of those bright and shining rising stars. And I haven't heard from him in a few years. Well, last year, he placed an order for several books. And he told me, he said, it's time for me to get back in the saddle, time for me to get involved again. I actually tried to reach him last year, but I simply could not get through to him. And I need to contact Larry Siegel, as a matter of fact, to see if he has contact information for him. I would like to get him involved because he is an excellent, excellent student of the Word. Now, he was ripped up. He was fired. He was ostracized. He got really, really burnt badly, and he withdrew. He withdrew for a while. But as I said, he told me just a couple of years ago that it was time for him to get started again. And so we hope that that will take place. We hope that he'll come to the point where he's willing to step out. You know, he's not a full-time preacher now, has a secular job. So in that regard, he certainly does not have to fear the wrath of the brethren and being fired for speaking his mind. So things are looking brighter and brighter and brighter as the days go on, as more and more individuals decide they can no longer stay on the sideline. You know, William, you've heard me say, and you've said it as well, I think, reformation, restoration, revolution is never enhanced, never furthered by spectators. It takes warriors. And being a warrior can be a troublesome, painful, stressful thing. I know that you hear from people all the time. I hear from people all the time who say, how in the world do you keep your sanity? How in the world do you keep your decorum with everybody in the world attacking you as a heretic and calling you slanderous names, making false accusations against you and what have you? And, you know, I generally tell people, well, over the years, I've developed a really, really thick skin. That's just all there is to it. And I know you have as well. You know, most of the time I'm able almost to laugh, literally to laugh at some of the ridiculous objections and even some of the ridiculous verbiage that is thrown my way and your way as well, because I know that in about 99% of the cases it comes from ignorance. They literally don't know what they're talking about, or they're commenting out of fear. They see their paradigm crumbling before their very eyes. You know, on YouTube just recently, I had somebody post a comment on one of my videos. Well, you are nothing but a damnable liar, and you're going to hell. And I wrote back, and I said, well, that's most assuredly the most devastating critique and refutation of covenant eschatology I've ever read in my life. You know, I couldn't help it. You know, I wrote back and I said, now, if you want to discuss Bible, and if you're willing to discuss Bible and present some exegesis for your reasons for believing and feeling this way, then feel free and I will be happy to engage you in honorable discussion. If, however, you are incapable of engaging in Christian decorum in dialogue, then don't bother posting on my YouTube video again. Well, guess what? They have it posted again. And so I strongly suspect that that particular individual is one that found himself or herself, whichever one it happened to be, I do not know. They didn't even have a picture attached. But I suspect that they saw their traditional, historical, personal eschatology going down the tubes. And so they had to make themselves feel better by lashing out at the one that they've been reading or listening to that is the cause of their consternation. And that happens a lot now. You and I have both seen it. We've seen it over and over and over again of people who have accosted us in that way, said, you are nothing but false teachers. And they come back and they have the courage, they have the conviction a couple of years later or whatever it happens to be. And they say, well, I owe you an apology. I now believe in covenant eschatology. We've both seen that happen over and over and over again. So, once again,
I suspect it will continue to happen.
I suspect it will continue to happen. It most assuredly will, because there are lots of honest hearts out there whose, you know, the initial gut reaction, admittedly, to covenant eschatology is, what in the world are you saying? I've never heard this in my life. And I made the comment in my debate with David Hester in Montgomery, Alabama. I said, I know that what I'm saying is shocking. Well, David Hester tried to make hay with that and try to make it mean that I was admitting that I was false, which shows that he was just simply desperate, just playing parlor tricks. He was playing debate games. That's not legitimate debate. But the point of fact is, I do understand you understand what it's like to hear someone say for the very first time, the Lord has already come. And it's just like Jesus. Jesus told his own apostles, I have many things to say to you, but you are not yet able to withstand them. And so, folks, we have to be sensitive to people's feelings, to people where they are at in their own journey, and take them from where they are to where they need to be. And sometimes that's a slow process. Sometimes it can be done more quickly. But the fact of it is, we have to be warriors, and we have to be willing to fight the fights. Well, listen, folks, thank you so very, very much for joining us for Two Guys in a Bible right here on Fulfilled Radio, a voice you can trust. Hope you've enjoyed our little bit of sharing about Preterist Pilgrim Weekend. It truly was a great time. We will have the DVDs and the MP3s available in the very near future, Lord willing, so that you can purchase those. So be watching for the announcement of that. In the meantime, thank you again for joining us. And with that, we will say good night and God bless.
Thank you for joining the Two Guys in a Bible radio broadcast. On behalf of Dunn Preston and myself, we'd like to say have a very pleasant day and may God bless. Until next time, we'll see you on Fulfill Radio, a voice you can trust.